Bernie Madoff conducted what was likely the largest global Ponzi scheme in history. In such frauds, the perpetrator is continually seeking out new investors to pay the earlier investors. They are houses of cards that eventually collapse. The collapse of Madoff's fraud left some 16,000 victims and actual losses of at least $20 billion. They included ultra-wealthy celebrities, but also retirees who lost their homes and pensions, as well as university endowments and large philanthropic organizations. Diana B. Enriquez is a veteran reporter for The New York Times. When Madoff was arrested in December 2008, and she learned that it was his sons who turned him in, she immediately sensed the Shakespearean proportions of the story. It has all the elements of a great tragedy: betrayal, ruin, revenge, hubris, and even suicide, including Madoff's own son, Mark. Enriquez's new book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust.
Talk about the title of the book.
Originally, the working title was A World of Lies. That appealed to me because it seemed to capture what made this Ponzi scheme so historic. It really was the world's first global Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes, by definition, almost never reach beyond the personal circle of the Ponzi schemer. It's a face-to-face crime. It's a crime where the fraudster earns your trust, usually customer by customer. This Ponzi scheme stretched from Palm Beach to the Persian Gulf, and the way it did so was that Madoff kind of hijacked other people's credibility, and his ultimate victim may not ever have heard of Bernie Madoff or trusted Bernie Madoff, but they trusted somebody who trusted somebody who trusted somebody who trusted Bernie Madoff. And that chain of trust that could stretch all around the world was a genuinely new thing for a Ponzi scheme. So A World of Lies seemed like the right thing. But then when I met Madoff in prison and realized how remarkable he was as a Ponzi schemer, not just that the Ponzi scheme itself was unusual, but he as a Ponzi schemer was so remarkable and had this magical magnetism that needed to be understood and explained, I wanted to put him at the center of it.
And you talked about the death of trust on many levels.
That is really what made this such a compelling story. It was about trust bestowed and trust betrayed. And it just happened to occur in finance. It happened to occur through a Ponzi scheme. But we bestow our trust and we are betrayed in any number of human circumstances. And so that really made it so universal. And that's why that the damage that Madoff did to the capacity of his victims and the rest of us to trust one another, to trust our regulatory institutions, to trust Wall Street, to trust our financial advisors, to trust anything, was so devastating that I thought that needed to be part of the story.
Why was he so charismatic? He wasn't flashy.
He wasn't the glad hander, the swashbuckler, the bon vivant in the corner buying everybody drinks and telling funny stories. That's the classic Ponzi schemer, and I've known half a dozen like that. That isn't Bernie Madoff, and it wasn't Bernie Madoff. He is a soft-spoken, self-deprecating, reserved sort of guy. His favorite evening out would have been dinner with Ruth, not some big gala, not some big party where he's holding forth. And I think that disarmed people. I think people who would have been automatically suspicious of the classic Ponzi personality couldn't imagine that this low-key guy could be a Ponzi schemer. He had a gift for making you feel like you were the most fascinating, interesting person he'd met. The classic Ponzi schemer wanted you to think he was the most fascinating, interesting person you'd ever met, and Bernie just turned that on its head. So it was a remarkable emotional jujitsu that he played on these investors.
Did you feel this at all when you met him for the first time?
Very much so. I mean, in retrospect, I can laugh about it. And I laughed about it pretty quickly. But I have to say, at the time when I was interviewing him in prison, I was not quite aware that he was using this jujitsu on me. I had very limited time to ask him the questions that I had that I wanted to ask. And so he took a digression into explaining some financial strategy that I already knew about. I didn't need to waste a minute on that. So I waved him on and said, I know how that works. Thanks. Well, he just casually turned to his lawyer with this little smile and he said, oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to someone who really understands the markets. I felt great. I felt wonderful. I mean, he made me feel like I was the most intelligent, best informed reporter he'd ever met. And so I know from personal experience how good that feels, how disarming that is. Now, it didn't take me long to remember, this is Bernie Madoff. This is how he does it. This is his magic touch. Watch and learn. So it didn't last for long, but it really was amazing to see the way he sprinkled pixie dust on me and made me feel so special.
He had a legitimate business. He'd been chairman of the NASDAQ. He revolutionized trading on Wall Street. What role did that play in helping him perpetuate this fraud?
It was critical, I think, to him carrying this fraud off for as long as he did. If all he had been was a money manager, he would never have had the kind of credibility that he had with regulators and with other people on Wall Street. But that was no one even knew he did that. That was a tiny piece of his background.
Can you, I know it's complicated, but could you explain briefly what a hedge fund is, why this was key to how he built this worldwide Ponzi scheme?
A hedge fund is a form of pooled investment, basically. All of us know pooled investments if we own mutual funds. Same thing. But hedge funds are managed a little differently, and the fee structure is different, and they are regulated differently. A hedge fund is a private collective investment fund. It doesn't have to report to anybody what it's doing. Its investors are presumed by law to be sophisticated investors with ample wealth to know what they're doing. And as long as a hedge fund complies with the rules in terms of who it's marketing itself to and how it's doing that, not trying to sell itself to the general public, not trying to advertise and attract new investors, then it really is free of most of the disclosure requirements that traditional mutual funds have to fulfill. That keeps it, again, below the radar of regulatory interest. So they were really only appropriate for people who could be their own policemen, who could read the documents themselves and assess the risks themselves. They were not appropriate for people who relied on the rules and regulations to make sure that the investment was honest.
You're listening to Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is an interview with Diana B. Enriquez, author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Enriquez said the evolution of the hedge fund market opened the way for many more people to become victims of Madoff's fraud.
In the great bull market days of the late 80s and the early 90s, and particularly in the late 90s, hedge fund performance was off the charts. Now, they were taking extraordinary risks to get those returns. There is an ironclad connection between risk and returns. So you were taking a lot of risk and you were getting paid to take it with these extraordinary 80%, 100% annual returns. The academic idea began, and I think this idea was actually originally rooted in academe. The notion said, why should the average investor who's saving for retirement be penalized with the puny returns you can get in public mutual funds? There actually is a well-documented movement I call hedge funds for everybody, where the notion came that, people are sophisticated enough to manage their own investments. Let's empower them all. Let's lower the barriers required to invest in hedge funds. At the same time, we had the housing bubble. Now, federal regulations established a minimum net worth that you had to have to be allowed to invest in a hedge fund by law. But as the housing bubble pushed up the value of your home, more and more and more Americans, if you counted your home equity, could qualify for hedge funds. The saddest of those are investors who actually mortgaged their homes to invest with Madoff. And when the Madoff fraud collapsed, they not only lost all their savings, but they lost their homes as well. People with some wealth began to be attracted by these extraordinary returns and were not sufficiently informed or careful about the extraordinary risks that went with those returns and began to find hedge funds more and more attractive. And that's why you saw so many middle-income and middle-upper-income investors putting their pension and retirement savings into feeder funds that were ultimately invested with Bernie Madoff.
A lot of nonprofits lost their endowments, and that included Elie Wiesel. You have an instance in your book. Were you at that event where he spoke?
I was.
Can you talk a little bit about it?
It was one of the most solemn moments, really. This was a breakfast event that was held not long after Madoff's arrest. Feelings were still very raw. And one of the people at this breakfast asked Elie Wiesel whether he could ever forgive Madoff. If Madoff were there in front of him and had asked his forgiveness, would he be able to forgive Madoff? And there was this long pause. Could have heard a pin drop while we waited for his answer. And when he said no, I kind of felt my heart break a little. Mm. That this man who had forgiven so much of the 20th century's savagery had been so injured, had been so betrayed by this scandal, that at that moment he did not feel he could forgive Bernie Madoff. For me, it was a marker. It was a milepost in how far down that road of betrayal we felt like we'd traveled. So it was a really moving moment. But certainly it was a moment that that captured a lot of how the Jewish philanthropic community felt about the Madoff scandal. To the extent that any good could have come out of the dreadful losses that so many worthy institutions experienced, I think Madoff did force many philanthropic institutions, both in the Jewish community as well as broader, to look at how they were managing their investments. They were going far too much on faith. They were relying far too much on who knew who. They were relying far too much on the generosity of their donors to guide them, and did not have enough in the way of firm rules and regulations.
Does Madoff know when he's lying?
I've wondered about that. I honestly do. Certainly, I saw him lie to me about whether or not he would give competing interviews, and he seemed perfectly sincere when he broke those promises and explained to me how it had come about. He always had some exculpatory explanation about how he really had never intended to actually break that promise, but things had happened that brought that about. When someone is so gifted at lies, I think you have to assume that they're just as good at lying to themselves as they are at lying to everybody else. And I think the first person Bernie lied to was Bernie. And he lied to himself about what he was doing. He lied to himself about whether he'd be able to get out of it. He lied to himself about how much harm it would cause. He lied to himself about how it would end. I think the lies he told himself were the first step in this enormous web of deceit.
What about his victims? What is the status in terms of recovering some of what? I knew this was a huge issue, but who gets paid, who should be paid, and how much they could recover to actually pay anybody?
The bankruptcy trustee has already recovered $10.6 billion, and that's through out-of-court settlements with people he sued, the sale of assets, including the trading platform that was Madoff's legitimate business. So the cash losses in this fraud, that is the sum total of all the money people gave Bernie and never took back, is about $17 to $20 billion. Well, right now, today, we're looking at a potential recovery then of at least 50 cents on the dollar. Historically, if you can get 5 cents on the dollar in a Ponzi scheme, it's a miracle. Now, there is a great division a fierce, sad, tragic division among the Madoff victims between those who gave money to Bernie and never took anything back, lost everything, not only their paper gains, but their actual cash. And then those people who gave money to Bernie and drew money out over the years thinking it was their profits, and through that process retrieved all of the actual cash that they'd given Bernie, but still sustained these enormous paper losses. Now, of course, they feel like losers. They feel like victims. They thought they had $5 million saved for retirement, and it's all gone. Worse than that, over the years, they took $2 million out of their Madoff account, and they'd only put $500,000 in. And now maybe the trustee wants them to give that $1.5 million in fictional profits back. Well, of course they're outraged. You know, there's no right or wrong here. There's no fair or unfair. It's the way the law works. But the people who haven't even gotten their cash back yet look at the people who have and say, how lucky were you? Why should you get any more money before we at least get back what we gave Bernie? So we should be first in line. And that battle has been one of the most heartbreaking things I've had to cover. It's going to continue on through the courts for years, but that's the tragedy of a Ponzi scheme. Every fraud pits the villain against the victim. The Ponzi scheme is the only fraud that pits one victim against another victim.
The Securities and Exchange Commission investigated Bernie Madoff a number of times, but never pinned anything on him. I asked Enriquez why he was able to dodge regulators.
Well, one of the reasons he was able to hide in plain sight, if you will, is that they didn't know he was managing money. His basic regulator was the National Association of Securities Dealers, now called FINRA, which regulates brokerage houses. And so when they came to visit, they were auditing and examining his brokerage operation, that legitimate business that operated up on the 19th floor of the Lipstick Building. Its customers were Merrill Lynch, Charles Schwab, Fidelity Funds. It traded stocks wholesale for all the biggest institutions on the street. Its books and records were meticulously maintained. He kept that legitimate business squeaky clean. At one level, that disarmed his regulators. Another strategy he used, which was even more diabolical, was to point suspicious people at the wrong crime. There were lots of sophisticated investors, particularly in the latter years of this fraud, who, if you put them on a lie detector and said, is Bernie Madoff 100% honest, would not have been able to give you yes as an honest answer. They suspected that he was cutting corners. Specifically, they suspected he was front-running. Now, front-running is a form of insider trading. That's illegal, and it's a crime. Not a big crime, but it's a crime. Lots of people thought Bernie was front-running. And Bernie, I think, actually encouraged them to think that. He certainly encouraged at least one team of SEC investigators to think he was front-running. He had a confrontation with them and said, well, what are you looking for? What are you looking for? And one of them said, well, what do you think we should be looking for, Bernie? And he said, front-running. Aren't you looking for front-running? Well, he kept directing them at the crime they would never pin on him because he wasn't doing it.
So these private investors and the feeder funds, did they think that he was actually taking their money and funneling it through Bernard Madoff Securities and doing actual trades? Is that what they thought was happening?
They thought he was using an analytical tool that he had devised, a computer-driven trading tool that allowed him to go in and out of the market, trading in Fortune 100 stocks for short periods of time to capture the very best of the market. Now, he told his own firm he was conducting these trades with counterparties in Europe. He was so clever. He would tell foreign auditors that he was trading with U.S. banks, and he would tell U.S. regulators he was trading with foreign banks, because he knew that the difficulty of doing cross-border investigations would deter anybody from asking the second and third questions. So this is a guy who knew the regulatory landscape down to the ground. He knew where its weaknesses were. He knew where its pitfalls were, and he knew how to play them like a pipe organ. None of them actually knew how much money he claimed to be trading, because if they had, they would have suddenly said, wait a minute, that would take more Microsoft shares than exist. But he had kept his big investors, his big streams of money, in separate silos. So they really didn't know that there was this whole other group of investors who were sending money to Madoff, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. They only really knew about the stream of money they were sending Madoff. And if he could keep those streams separate, each of them would look plausibly small to make it reasonable, perhaps, that he was pursuing this real strategy.
Some of really well-respected financial funds quietly started blacklisting him and not investing in him, but never told anyone that.
That's, I really think, a question that Wall Street really needs to wrestle with. There is a culture of silence that you simply do not blow the whistle on other people on Wall Street. The notion of an honor code that I will neither lie, cheat, nor steal, nor tolerate those who do, has never found a home on Wall Street. And until it does, regulators are always going to be up against that wall of silence. Think how differently this would have turned out if the whistleblower who kept trying, Harry Markopoulos, kind of an odd guy.
Oh, that was a fascinating character.
Unable to communicate clearly with people who weren't as smart as he was, but thought he could, rubbed people the wrong way, suspected everybody, trusted nobody. If that very flawed but very determined and in some ways kind of noble whistleblower had had the backing of a half dozen really respected figures on the street, practitioners, people who were hedge fund managers themselves or industry consultants or private bankers, if the SEC had gotten calls from them too, not just from Harry, would this story have been different? I don't know, but I think it's a question that Wall Street really needs to keep asking itself, and we need to ask that question of Wall Street too. You know, the SEC has greatly upgraded its whistleblower program. It has extended its bounty program so that people who turn in bad guys on Wall Street can share in some of the money the SEC collects in fees and fines. So it is trying to encourage people to swim against that current of silence. I hope it's successful, because until it is, we're still going to be in the same shape we were with Madoff.
Madoff's investors never got unusually high returns, but they always got steady returns, regardless of what was happening in the market. And that's because the returns were all fake. He never invested their money, but used later investors to pay off earlier investors. But some Ponzi schemes often have very high rates of return, such as 20 or 25%. I asked Diana Enriquez why more people didn't question such results.
That is the classic Ponzi scheme, and I share your skepticism that people could have somehow deceived themselves that this was appropriate. Now, different asset classes, assets that you don't understand very well, you may not twig to how out of line these returns are. I talked to some Madoff investors who, when I said that to them, look, you were getting 8%. And at that time, you know, treasury bills were super safe. That's as safe as you thought you were. But they were only paying half that. And one of these was a retired school teacher in New Mexico. And she said, I had no idea what treasury bills were. I never looked at the business pages. These were folks who truly had no idea what a reasonable rate of return was. A lot of baby boomers came of age in the great bull market of the 1980s, and they started investing maybe in the late 70s when you could get 22%. You could get 13, 14, 15% on a bank CD. They came of age at a time when the stock market was gaining at an extraordinary pace, where you could put your money in the Magellan Fund and see it double in 5 years. So the generic investor, uninformed about the changes in the market, might well not have seen these rates of return as highly implausible. But see, that's what investors need to know. If you're investing in something, what's the general rate of return in that asset class? You know, if you're investing in the stock market, what's happening to the S&P? Now, that wouldn't have helped you with Madoff, because he was careful to always pay you an appropriate rate of return. So it wouldn't have helped you a lot with Madoff until markets became so volatile. And then you probably should have started to wonder, well, how come everyone else is swinging, you know, 100 points this way and 100 points that way, and Bernie's not? He would have had an answer for you, but at least you would have asked the question.
Diana Enriquez makes a compelling case in her book, The Wizard of Lies, that neither Bernie Madoff's sons, Andrew and Mark, nor his wife, Ruth, were involved in his fraud. None of them have been the subject of investigations or prosecutions, yet they have been publicly vilified in a way that Enriquez said is unheard of.
Historically, I've never seen anything like it. It's very rare. I can count on one hand the number of instances in which a close relative, an unindicted, uninvestigated close relative of a white-collar criminal has been subjected to the kind of scrutiny and the kind of vilification that the Madoff family experienced. They were dragged to the whipping post of public scrutiny, and it was really surprising to me. It was stunning to Madoff. He told me that that was the one thing that really blindsided him. He was completely unprepared for the public attacks on his wife and children. He knew they were going to be financially ruined. He knew that. But he thought that by standing up, pleading guilty, confessing what he did, going to prison for 150 years, he was carrying the guilt. It never occurred to him that the public would never forgive Ruth, Mark, and Andrew, that they would continue to be under fire and under attack. And he couldn't do anything about it. The one time he broke down in prison when I interviewed him was in the first interview when I asked him about his wife's decision to stay with him after his arrest, which brought her great vilification, although I will point out his sons cut him off immediately, and they were vilified anyway. So he grieved at how his family had been treated, and of course his son's suicide just shattered him. I saw him in prison. My second interview with him was 2 months, almost to the day after Mark's suicide. And I did not recognize him when I entered the visiting room at prison, same room I'd interviewed him in August, the previous August. I thought it was maybe a janitor. I did not recognize him as the man I had interviewed in August. He had lost an enormous amount of weight. His uniform was rumpled. His shirt button was unbuttoned. I mean, the dapper dandy Bernie Madoff. He looked gray, badly shaven. He was shattered by the death of his son, Mark. And I think to the extent that I had never really been able to perceive any authentic feeling remorse in Madoff up until that point. Denial, yes. True remorse, no. In that encounter, I did begin to think he was finally learning that this was, that the cost of his crime couldn't be calculated just in dollars and cents, that his crime had destroyed people's lives, and it had just destroyed his own and destroyed his son and his wife's life. So I think that might have been perhaps the first step towards genuine remorse that Madoff felt.
You'd said before, when you started the story, you could see the Shakespearean dimensions of it, and I think you just showed why.
You know, Madoff was a man. He wasn't a monster. He was a human being, a deeply flawed human being. I mean, tragic in the Greek sense of tragic. That is, a person with enormous gifts, enormous possibilities, who because of a fatal flaw in their character destroys themselves. He destroyed himself and everybody else who trusted him. Yes, there is a dimension of his story that is timeless. truly timeless. It wasn't a crime of the moment. I know a lot of people like to connect the Madoff fraud with the bubble decade, with the fall of Lehman and all of its aftermath. That they see the Madoff crime as kind of rooted in that period. That's wrong. That is profoundly wrong. Madoff neither was a product of that bubble nor a creator of that bubble. Indeed, his fraud began, we believe, long before that bubble decade. Men like Madoff will always be with us and always have been. They'll find a way because we're hardwired to trust one another. And there will always be the human being that will exploit that to steal from us. Now, there are two ways to approach that. One is to say, well, I just won't trust anybody. That's a cure worse than the disease, frankly. Another way is to say, okay, I understand that my instinct is to trust, so I've got to protect myself from that instinct by establishing smart rules for myself and being humble about the fact that I'm going to make mistakes, the fact that I can't be sure I'm always right about the people I trust. So this tendency of ours to trust and the vulnerability that that leaves for us is timeless. It applies to every aspect of our lives. Learning that we trust too well and not always wisely is an important thing to learn about ourselves so that we can protect ourselves from the harm of trusting too much and trusting the wrong person. So it's not about finance. It's not about Wall Street. It's not about money. It's about how humans relate to one another and how to protect yourself from the evil that that can cause without denying yourself all the wonderful good that that brings about.
Diana B. Enriquez is a reporter with the New York Times. Her book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. For Women's Focus, I'm Megan Kamrick.